Picasso knows your vacation home is your best home. It's the place that brings family and friends together. It's where you're the best version of yourself. Picasso makes it easy to co-own a luxury vacation home in amazing locations. Listings start at $200K for 1/8 ownership. Picasso does the hard parts for you. Luxury furnishings, maintenance, billing, scheduling, and more. With a home management team that provides support before, during, and after your stay, so you can focus on the relaxing, hosting, and making memories with family and friends. And you can resell on Picasso's marketplace anytime, historically for a 10% gain. With Picasso, you can stop saying someday and start building family traditions today in a vacation home you own and revisit time after time. Visit Picasso.com today to see thousands of luxury vacation home listings. That's PACASO.com.
Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire. With the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Hi, hello, welcome. This is Let's Talk About Myths, baby. And I'm your host, Liv, i.e. that woman who typically avoids philosophy wherever possible, because this is not, generally, a philosophy podcast, except for the time I went on and on about Atlantis, and also today, kind of. So I spoke with the absolutely wonderful Caitlin Boulding. Caitlin is a PhD student doing her dissertation on the Timaeus, and it shows. And not only did we just basically become friends within the first words we spoke to each other and then talked about life nothingness for like half an hour before we finally got to the content of today's episode, don't worry, I cut that out, but we also just went with whatever Caitlin wanted to talk about, or more like what she knows best, and that is Plato's Timaeus, which honestly, it blew my mind with how exciting and fascinating her insights into this dialogue and Plato broadly and everything interconnected are. You may recognize the name, Timaeus, because that is the dialogue of Plato where Atlantis is first mentioned. And full disclosure, we did record this back in April, so the Atlantis series I'd done was a hell of a lot fresher when we spoke. So hopefully that doesn't result in any confusion for you all, but hey, feel free to listen back to that amazing series of episodes, because why the hell not? Caitlin provides so much context for the writing of the Timaeus and the Critias, and this introduction of Atlantis. It actually adds so much to my series on the work, because now we're looking at when Plato was writing, what was going on around him, and why he was writing to begin with, what the context is on the people that he has telling the stories. It really introduces so many important aspects that I know you all will be fascinated by. as well as connections with mythology and Hesiod specifically. Whew. Plus, we honestly just had so much fun. I learned so much. You can hear me just taking it all in. Listening back, I'm like, right, my brain doesn't process bits of history and philosophy as well as I process mythology, and everything was clearly just swirling around in my brain as I listened. I'm obsessed with this episode, not least because I really appreciate these added details on what Plato might have been doing when he wrote the Timaeus, but also just the historical aspects surrounding these dialogues. Just, it's so good. I can't wait for y'all to listen. Maybe I should stop rambling and just let you get in here. Conversations, getting trapped in Plato's web, Timaeus, Atlantis, and Hesiodic myth with Caitlin Boulding.
I'd love to talk more about the Timaeus, I think.
Please.
Yeah.
So I did a lot on the Critias mostly because, because I don't think I read the full Timaeus because...
No one should read the Timaeus.
Great, I'm glad to hear that.
Yes.
I often feel like, oh, I should read the whole thing, but I'm also like, no, I'm just going to like get my context from...
This is
just
my tagline.
People talking about it.
I always tell everyone, don't read the Timaeus. I think that, and I say Timaeus, but I mean Timaeus Critias because... They are, in my opinion, and this is something people argue about, but it appears that they are two parts of a trilogy that was unfinished, right? So I think of them as one thing.
Yeah. I mean, they also nestle together completely.
Yeah, exactly. So the Atlantis stuff is in both the Timaeus and the Critias. But yeah, I think that working on the Atlantis section, it's like, it's the biggest gap between how exciting people think your research is going to be and how exciting it actually is. I have a lot of people I'm like, oh yeah, I'm writing about the myth of Atlantis, and they're like, oh, what book should I read? And I'm like, not the Timaeus.
No,
I have no recommendations.
I just find it all so interesting because, so for instance, like I obviously covered like Atlantis in every way that I could find without ever once I basically was like, I'm going to keep all my research to the ancient world. Meaning that my research is Plato. And then just briefly touch upon how it got dark, you know, how it became a myth of white supremacy basically.
Yeah.
But otherwise just not even touch upon any of the bullshit around it. I just did the Atlantis bit of the Timaeus and then the whole of the Critias. But
right,
somebody recently sent me a note about it, and I think it's just so hard to get across to people exactly how it functions as a piece of writing, because it's really hard to wrap your head around what Plato is and is not doing.
And this is what I want to talk about, because this
great.
Is what this chapter of my dissertation is on.
Oh, yes.
And so, so this is something that I've been researching. And so I'm really interested in how Plato is engaging with Hesiod. And that's sort of what the whole dissertation project is. The first chapter is on the myth of Pandora and how the myth of Pandora shows up in the Timaeus. So generally, the Timaeus is most famous for the cosmogony, the creation of the world. And as a part of that, there's a big part where he does a creation of the human body, which again, sounds great. Don't recommend it.
I feel like that's the TLDR of Plato.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that some Plato is more interesting to read. And I think Plato is an amazing writer, and he has all of this wordplay. There's tons of puns. There's all of these weird character things. I'm very interested in it as the genre conventions of the philosophical dialogue. But yeah, the Timaeus, I think it becomes incredibly influential in the Roman world. And it's one of the, it's the dialogue that has the most reach and impact. And so it's very impactful. And it's something that I took a class on the Timaeus at Dalhousie. Shout out to Eli Diamond. I wrote a terrible paper on like, what is the chore? Because there's all these really strange concepts in the Timaeus. And then I studied in Germany and I took a class on the Timaeus in German, like a seminar. Wild. And I did not know German very well at the time, but I took this class and I was just like so confused still about what the heck was going on. And so then when I went to write my dissertation, I was like, yes, I should definitely work on this dialogue that I still am confused by. Maybe in the process of writing the dissertation, I will understand the Timaeus. And no, I do not. But because there's all of this. Okay, and I will tell you another thing, and I don't know if this will make it in or not, but the other thing that I'm really excited about the Timaeus is that my friend and I once went to an aerial silk show in Seattle.
Okay, where is this going to Plato? I'm so
based
excited.
On Plato's Timaeus. It was Plato's Timaeus as a like circus show, and it was all about the sacred geometries. And it was wild. And I was like, I can't believe this exists.
I am blown away.
Yes. So that happened. And I was like, yes, this is. And at the end of it, I went up to the director or something. And I was like, hey, so I'm a PhD and I work on this. This is absolutely insane that you made this show. Like, it was about the element, because there's all of this very, the hard part of it about the Timaeus is it's very mathematical and very scientific and yeah, all about like changes of matter and states. But coming back around to what the dissertation is about, I'm interested in how Plato is dealing with his own canonical texts at the time. So for Plato, the text of Hesiod, which, as you talked about, I think it's oral poetry, right? So it was composed orally and then performed, and it's performed for hundreds of years up until the time of Plato, and it's performed at these festivals. So it's sort of similar to how we experience Shakespeare, but even more influential. And so he's rewriting his own canon at that time in the Timaeus Critias.
Interesting. I've never really thought about Hesiod. I mean, I've thought about it as oral poetry, obviously, but like I haven't thought about it as being performed. I don't know why. I think it's just because it's
didactic.
Yeah.
It's so strange. Yeah.
That's the thing. Like, it sits in a different place in my mind than Homer does. Like Homer feels performative in a way that Hesiod doesn't. So that's
One of the things about that is because Hesiod has all these genealogies and, you know, things that Homer is so narrative oriented. Mm-hmm. And so that makes sense to us as what would be performed. But the genealogies they're one of the things that when you read them in English are very boring.
And yet I've done it countless times.
Yeah. But I think they make, you know, they're good for your show because you can pull these, they're such good sources of myth. Mm-hmm. But the poetry of them really comes about, you can tell that they're good more when you're translating the Greek, because there's all of this sonic wordplay, these folk etymologies. And so they're really worthwhile to translate, and they're very interesting in translating them. And so they would be nice to listen to and perform, you know? And like it's so there's this festival culture of competing at festivals with oral performances. And the Timaeus is set at the Panathenaea, which is this festival celebrating Athena and celebrating Athens as a city, and at the Pan Athenaia is partially known for the competitions that are hosted at the festival, both athletic competitions and poetic competitions. Some people say that we've got both Homeric recitation competitions and choral recitations. Mm. And other people argue that Hesiod would also be performed in that context.
Interesting.
So, yeah. And so I'm really interested in the fact that the Timaeus is a radically new cosmogony where things come about not through the process of birth, which we find in the theogony, right? The mm-hmm. gods giving birth. And that's how you fill out the universe, but rather by this craftsman figure. And so that's a big departure. Mm-hmm. And it's set at the time when you would be at a festival. So the people who are reading Plato, they know the context of the Pan Athenaia. And they think like, oh yeah, I went to the Pan Athenaia and I saw Hesiod and I heard about the story of how the gods give birth and that's how you get the universe. But instead, we get this conversation and these speeches by Timaeus and Critias, that Timaeus's speech is all about this cosmogony. Mm-hmm. And the process of the cosmogony is craft rather than birth. And then within the dialogue, there's a setup of a competition, and the speeches are guest gifts that are given back to Socrates in thanks for the speech that he had given the day before. Mm-hmm. So there's this sort of like gift giving, repayment, and also a competitive nature to that as well, because that's a big part of the gift culture, or even if you think of like the succession myth, part of the theogony. Mm-hmm. But like myth of Pandora, Prometheus, exchange, and you know, this building exchange where you have to one up the thing that you're exchanging next. And so there's this element of competition within that that's at the level of the characters against each other, but then also embedded within it, the myth of Atlantis, which is not a myth, as we've talked about, mm-hmm. not together yet, but
as you've talked about. As I have gone on and on and on
about. It's not a myth. Yeah, no. And it's not a myth, but it's a pseudo-myth. So it's really interesting to me, like, why is Plato making it appear like a myth? And he gives it this pseudo-poetic pedigree through the figure of Solon, but also through this, like, really complex narratological framing, right? Where he has this...
Really dangerously complex, because it really... Like, it truly is dangerous because the complexity with which Plato presents this goddamn story.
Yeah, we don't even get the story. We just...
No. And, like, but the like, framing of it as, like, so Solon told my dad, and then my dad told me, and these priests told Solon that. Like, that, even just that bit is what leads so many people to misunderstand, like unintentionally misunderstand it for being like an actual piece of history. So like this is the message that I got recently, which was like, and to be clear, I'm not insulting this listener at all. I think it's a really common problem when we're dealing with trying to understand this, but you don't have the background to sort it out. But like, this is why it's just like a huge problem. It's like people just misunderstand it this way. But he was basically like, you know, well, if Solon did really hear this, then these different things could be real. And I'm like, yeah, but you're misunderstanding. Like, the whole point is that, like, no, Solon didn't hear this because Plato has no connection to Solon.
Oh, that's amazing. Yes. you know who would love that? Plato.
Oh my God.
This is Plato's whole game, right? Like,
yes.
He's setting this up. And then, so we've got the festival context to these dialogues, and that's the setting. And they're having this conversation at a dinner, right? So you're at this cultural event that takes place over multiple days. It's a big deal. Everyone comes into town, and there's the side events, which are actually like probably more interesting, where you're having these conversations with Timaeus, who, you know, he's in town from southern Italy. He's reached the peak of all philosophy. And Critias, who may or may not be like the tyrant. Okay. The fact that Plato also puts this into the mouth of the same guy who is both his like uncle and maybe one of the 30 tyrants is wild. I have many thoughts about this, which I cannot substantiate in my TBD. Read this chapter of the dissertation. But then within this backstory, it's at another festival that Critias learns the story. And again, this is a fiction. It's very yes. Borges. Have you read a lot of Borges? Like,
no.
Okay, that's okay. He's got like these these short stories, like the story about the Book of Sand. They all have these interesting narratological framings, by which I mean it's a story about how you learn this story. Kierkegaard does this too in the Either Or, where he says at the very beginning of this philosophical work, I walked by this window with a dresser in it every day. And then one day, and I kept looking at this dresser and I always wanted to buy it. And then one day I brought the dresser and I opened up the drawer and I found this book. And it's like, what, oh. Kierkegaard? Like the, like he finds, there's this framework for, I didn't write this, I found it, right? So giving a fake backstory is this thing that writers do. And so I'm really interested in why Plato's doing this and how it relates to the context where he's setting this, which is to say that he's trying to make his philosophical dialogue place that in competition with the poetry that's telling these myths, that's part of this festival. So that's my like big argument.
I'm taking it all in it's Plato and it's because it's these dialogues. Like it's so hard, I guess, to like really fully wrap your head around it. But on top of that, it's hard to then express it. Like I'm just sort of taking in everything based on how I tried to explain it all to people in my Atlantis series. And I think this definition is going to be so helpful. So I'm really excited that you wanted to talk about it because you understand Plato more than I do. And so I was just like, I don't have a background in Plato at all. I was just trying to do the Atlantis bit. And it's just like his choice to frame it this way is so fascinating, but also... Mm-hmm. Yeah, makes it so difficult to like actually wrap your head around later.
Okay, so the other thing that I will say that is really interesting to me about this piece is that he assigns this pedigree to a poetic pedigree to a figure who is responsible for really important things in Athens. So Solon the lawgiver, mm-hmm. and it's at this festival that's all about Athens and celebrating the, you know, what makes Athens Athens, and also the pan part of the Panathenaia, that which is bringing together these different tribes within Athens. And Solon goes to Egypt, and there's another part there where the place in Egypt that he goes to is also like the sister city of Athens, oh. and governed by Athena. Oh. And the priest tells Solon that the Athenians are all children and that they don't have any intellectual depth. They don't have the same kind of length of knowledge, mm-hmm. because their stories and their way of conveying information and knowledge is continually wiped out by these fires and floods.
Mm.
And also, but in the Nile, things are preserved, and they're partially preserved because they write everything down. And then the priests preserve the written record. So if we think about Hesiod and this mm-hmm. culture of oral composition, performance, and then performance at festivals, so still the way that Plato is receiving this poetry, Homeric and Hesiodic poetry, which is again like 400 years or so before, is through these performances, this oral performance, and Solon, he's set up this fake story about how Solon's got an even older story because he was able to access it through the Egyptians because of writing. So this is another level of the kind of competition that Plato is setting up with canonical poetry.
Right. So this is me wrapping my head through non-mythological things in a way that I'm not used to doing.
Yeah, sorry. I fooled you by coming on here and talking about philosophy.
No, I am obsessed with it.
Yeah.
I'm truly so thrilled. But I'm also just like, this is so not my wheelhouse in a way that I'm like super interested in. But so, and then the truth of kind of like, so I've recently had a couple different people on to talk about Egypt, which is very helpful. But yeah. My understanding about like, and this is again, this is going to be like very broad, obviously, but we were specifically talking about Herodotus in Egypt, is that like Egyptian priests, mostly like when it comes to things being written down, is it that it's also like a lot of Egyptian propaganda and stuff, like they didn't really write down things that were bad, or like my understanding basically is just to say like it's just even more unrealistic that the Egyptians would have actually written down something like this.
Oh yeah, the Egyptians definitely did not write this down because it did not exist. Like this,
well,
is
that
like,
yeah,
fictional,
that much I know, right? Like 100% yes. This is not a thing. But I mean, even if it, like, even hypothetically, the Egyptians yeah. wouldn't have written something like this down, even if it were hypothetically possibly real. Yeah, and then also, like, the question of Solon, obviously, like, he's, like, generations removed from Plato, so that's a whole other thing. Exactly. Like, no, none yes. of this is real.
Yes. And it's very interesting, too, because he says, okay, the Egyptian priest has written down, there's also a really interesting demythologizing part of this, where they say the story of, I believe, Phaethon and the story of the floods, Kira.
And Deucalion, yeah.
And Deucalion and the flood, those are ways of describing the ecological disasters that happened in your country, but you don't remember them because you don't have any, because your like collective understanding was wiped out at that time. Mm-hmm. So I find that really interesting. Mm-hmm. But just to get back to the written versus oral tradition piece of it, the Egyptian is saying we have this written record, and then from there goes through, it's orally transmitted from Solon to the great-grandfather to the grandfather, and then at a festival as a child Critias learns it, and there's this emphasis on age, like he learns it when he's very young, and then even within the dialogue he practices telling it because he thinks he might have forgot it, so there's all of this like memory and remembering through oral performance that's a part of it. Which then like keys into the performance as competitive, as a part of this competitive culture.
And I mean, does that tie into to like Plato commenting without commenting on the nature of memory and like what humans can and cannot like easily remember, and how that ends up being stories, like stories being flawed, or is that sort of not his interest necessarily?
So, you know, he does that a lot in other dialogues on writing, specifically the Phaedrus, where that dialogue's all about, there's another myth and relationship, there's another Egyptian priest in this myth, and that dialogue's all about how you can't convey knowledge through writing, and that writing down things means you forget them, but if you don't have the technology of writing, then your memory is better. So in some ways it's sort of the opposite in that one. So he talks about that there. I would say when we kind of zoom out to the, I don't know if I'm going to talk about this super cogently, but when we zoom out to the Timaeus, there's this big theme of the ekos mouthos and the ekos logos, which means likely story. Either in likely story as likely mouthos or likely logos, likely story, likely explanation. And Timaeus continually says that his cosmogony that he presents is a likely story, which is, it sort of ties back to this theme of truth within mythology. And Timaeus talks about the difficulty of knowing anything about these kind of subjects where you're talking about the birth of the universe. How can we really talk about this? We can only access a likely story because we aren't gods, so we weren't there. And I don't know. Okay, does that tie back to what we were talking about?
Enough. Because I think that's, I mean, that's really interesting generally, because then it makes me just think of Atlantis, because obviously, like, my brain is going to tie all this back to Atlantis because I haven't even read the full Timaeus, let alone any other Plato. But I mean, like, so it just remind me if you think of it, but like when Critias then follows up Timaeus's whole speech with the story of Atlantis, like, is he presenting a likely story, or is he like going for the opposite or not interested in the same way? It just makes me wonder about like what that is meant to be. Like, he's presumably talking about, or he's, you know, he's saying he's talking about his own memory, but is there like a sort of suggestion that it's like an unlikely or a likely story, or what was the other one you said?
So they're both likely stories. One is more like a likely explanation, the logos piece of it, or a likely story, mouthos, and people have a lot of arguments about why he's using mouthos and logos. In any case, I do want to put one caveat, which I think about all the time. Like, Plato wrote this unfinished trilogy, unless we lost some of it, which is possible. And I just spend years of my life thinking about this thing that Plato just decided to stop writing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so when we're talking about the Critias, especially, like, okay, what is this? And we're just driving ourselves crazy. He would have loved that.
Oh, yeah. Because, I mean, like, God, the extent to which, like, I often think about, like, if Plato could learn what this has become.
Right, like, yeah.
I mean, just the story of Atlantis generally, like, and what it is now, and, like, what misconceptions people have about it because of what it has become. Like, I mean, I'm fascinated by the idea of, like, what he would think about it. You know, would he just think it's hilarious because he had all these intentions to just immediately, like maybe the Critias ends with, haha, joking, you know, like, not actually, but like, maybe he's all an example of bullshit, you know, maybe that was his whole intention, is like for Critias to finish his whole story of the destruction of Atlantis and all these different things, and then just be like, and that was an example of X, and, you know, like, that was an example of a totally made up story, or, you know, I mean, it's not likely, but like, there's just so many things that he could have been intending that would change every single thing we think of when it comes to Atlantis, which in itself is wild that it is the story that it is, given it only appears in these two weird unfinished dialogues.
Yes. And it's such a footnote in all of Plato's work.
Yeah. It's like not a thing you want to read.
In Plato's work are like way more the myth of air is like way more influential, but I find it fascinating. I also there's a part in the Timaeus, in the Critias, where in the myth of Atlantis he's talking about how the names that we only know about this through the names that remain. I find that part really fascinating. And we don't remember what these names actually mean, but then he goes through and he talks about what the names, how the names relate. And that's very that's what Hesiod does all the time, right? Mm-hmm. He's always explaining why something is what it is based on the name and a sort of fake etymology for the name. So it's not an etymology in the way that we think of an etymology, but it's like Aphrodite is named Aphrodite because she was born from the foam, which is called Aphros. And she's smile loving because the word for smile is also related to that name. And so there's this thing that Plato's doing as well, where he's like, oh, these names are how we still have this inkling to this story. And so again, I think he's mimicking how myth is told in the sources that we have that are canonical for his time. And so what he would be experiencing, he's like, oh yeah, I'm gonna make this sound really legit. And so that's why I say he would be really excited if people, when people believe that it's really legit.
Picasso knows your vacation home is your best home. It's the place that brings family and friends together. It's where you're the best version of yourself. Picasso makes it easy to co-own a luxury vacation home in amazing locations. Listings start at $200K for 1/8 ownership. Picasso does the hard parts for you. Luxury furnishings, maintenance, billing, scheduling, and more. With a home management team that provides support before, during, and after your stay, so you can focus on the relaxing, hosting, and making memories with family and friends. And you can resell on Picasso's marketplace anytime, historically for a 10% gain. With Picasso, you can stop saying someday and start building family traditions today in a vacation home you own and revisit time after time. Visit Picasso.com today to see thousands of luxury vacation home listings. That's PACASO.com.
Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
But, you know, I find the framing around it so much more interesting than the myth itself, which is not most people.
No, I completely agree. Like, I absolutely, like, that's the thing that blew my mind most, because I, you know, am like of the age group, we're basically the same age, like, of like, coming across Atlantis 100% through pop culture, through the Disney movie specifically, and just like this notion that even if it, like, that I never assumed it was history, but I did assume it was a Greek myth, because it is presented like a Greek myth. Whenever you think about it, it's so commonplace in terms of like, oh, you have an underwater city, it's Atlantis. Like, oh, you have a lost city, it's Atlantis. Like, it's mm-hmm. it's just so common. And so I just, like, fully assumed it was a Greek myth. And then I think, like, I learned it was just in Plato. And then I was like, okay, well, Plato must present it like it's a myth. And, like, even he is not doing that. Like, you read it, and it's just, like, he's just so clearly, like, setting mm-hmm. up this whole, like, long-winded and, like, narratological advice or a device where he's like, I'm trying to prove a different point, and I'm mm-hmm. gonna do it through this. Mm-hmm. And now the more I hear from you, like, and this kind of leads to another question I meant to ask earlier, because I mean, I definitely, like, without the background of, like, why and when he was producing this, which I probably should have looked up, but I didn't.
I'm happy to tell you.
Well, yeah, even just what you've shared now, I'm like, great, this is a perfect extra context I could have used. And so I'm thrilled to have this now. But, like, to me, reading it just straight, he's just so obviously, like, pumping up at Athens and being like, look how cool we are. Which now hearing this background of, like, well, it was performed at the Panathenaea, like, yes. Like, okay, clearly he's like, look how cool we are.
Kind of.
But maybe not.
So I have some notes, I think.
Great.
This is a part that I haven't finished this section, and I'm still researching this. And I have, you know, with Plato, it's always so tricky because you can never say Plato says, or just an impossible thing. But I'm very interested with the character choices that he uses clues to the arguments that he's making. But he's writing this at a time when everything has fallen apart in Athens.
Right.
They have lost. They won the Persian War, and then they lost the Peloponnesian War, and then democracy failed, and then there was the tyrants. Now democracy is, I think we're in the time of, like, just after the 30 tyrants. And so a lot of people were just killed. Like, things got really bad. Things are really bad. And he's setting this dialogue in a prior time. And Hippocrates, we haven't talked about, but he's another guy. Right. He's one of the three people.
Because he might as well not be there, but, like, also he's there. Yeah.
He's there. But Hippocrates, he's a Syracusan general during the Athenian-Sicilian expedition in the midst of the Peloponnesian War. So he's a character in the Timaeus and the Critias. He doesn't have a big part. He's just a bit part player. But he's the one who Plato decided not to write his speech.
Yeah.
So Hippocrates is supposed to have a speech at the end of this. And so when Athens sent an armada to conquer Sicily, Hippocrates called for the expanding of the anti-Athenian coalition. He sent ambassadors to Sparta, Corinth, Carthage, and Italy seeking allies.
Interesting.
So he's on the other side of this war, right, that they've just lost.
So he was not Athenian?
We get a reference to Hippocrates from Thucydides, where he appears at the Congress of Gela. And he's demanding that the Sicilian Greeks stop their quarreling and unite against the Athenians, who had been attacking the Sicilian cities in support of Corinth. Okay, I wanted to check to make sure I was right about that, because it's really strange, right?
Yeah.
So we've got this Sicilian, and this is a huge thing in the Peloponnesian War, the Sicilian expedition. This is where everything goes to shit. And Alcibiades does some bad things, and I'm not an expert, so I'd have to have prepped more to talk about this cogently, and don't take away my PhD. But this is a huge point in the Peloponnesian War, and the fact that we've got this Sicilian general as one of the people who's talking to Socrates, the Athenian. They're talking about Solon, the Athenian lawgiver. And Timaeus is another figure who he is fictional. So he didn't really exist, but he's given this backstory of being a philosopher and a general. And then Critias, who most people think this isn't the Critias of the 30 tyrants, but again, an Athenian who, if it at very least, it's evoking a very famous name mm-hmm. that Plato's readers at that time are going to be really aware of. So these character choices are very emotional for everyone involved, right? Yeah. Like, we're in a war situation that just ended very poorly. Things are really bad, and this is set at a time before that happens.
Yeah.
And then we're given this story of Atlantis fighting, and, you know, so there's this naval warfare element, there's this, you know, I don't know how to, like, it unfortunately, we don't have the end of it.
Yeah, we don't really have the Athenians much in it.
Right, exactly, exactly. Yeah. So we're missing that piece, but this is supposed to be an illustration of the people that Timaeus has described coming into existence. So we've got a cosmogony from the birth of the universe leading to how human beings are created, and then how women and animals are created as a very short joking footnote at the end of that, which I do want to come back to because you mentioned that the Critias could just end in a joke. The Timaeus ends in a joke. But then these are supposed to be these people fully fleshed out and fighting and having this warfare. So, yes. But maybe we can come back to the Timaeus ending in a joke.
Please. So, okay. So then this kind of like adjusts my theory. Which, again, like, obviously my version of theory is just like the thing I thought of without, you know, knowing all that much background on the history side, because really mythology is my thing. And I really just decided to dive right into history with Atlantis, not history, but history with Plato. Jeez. But so then it sounds more like what he's doing is more like evoking the varied times when Athens was, well, I guess not even with the Critias question or the Hermocrates one, because it otherwise, though, like, because the story that Critias tells obviously is, like, from what we have, is pretty pro Athens, and like even they set it up in the Timaeus as being pretty pro Athens as well.
Sure.
So it's almost more like this, like, Athens was so great, you know, when they fought Atlantis, but then it sounds like it's pro at Athens now, but then also the use of these characters suggests that there's like something else going on in there. Obviously there is some, like, lots of stuff going on there because it's Plato anyway.
Okay. Thank you for bringing me back around to that, because I forgot why we were talking about Hermocrates. yes. I think that that's what's happening. It's very on the surface pro Athens. And then there are these subtle critiques with the character choices.
And it also seems like it's like critiques also in the way they describe Athens in the time of Atlantis, because it's like a very different city, right? It's like, it's almost like you can, based on the description, like a more modern word that you could use is like almost communism or Marxism, because he's very much like everyone has their own place, everyone fits into the system. Like, obviously he tosses in his whole like, oh, and there's only ever this many people, and you're like, well, how do you keep it that way? There's a lot happening in there. But like the way he describes the city is such a utopia, such like a perfect setup for how like how a culture should thrive and all these different things, which is like very notably different from any of the Athens that he's experienced, like democracy or otherwise.
Right. Yeah. And this is also ties into the Republic, because a lot of people talk about how this description of a city is a reiteration of the description of the ideal city in the Republic.
Yeah, it's like a revision, but, right? Because he gets rid of the philosopher kings.
Well, it's very strange, because it's just different. It's sort of like I'm telling the same story, but it's missing a bunch of things, and it's not the same. There's an argument by Gregory Nagy where he talks about how this is like a fictionalized version of the Republic, which I kind of like because of these other aspects of sort of fictionalizing the myth of the Timaeus.
Mm-hmm.
But I to this day, I'm very confused as to, it seems like it's placing these, it's a note to go reread the Republic.
Right.
It's like a plug. Hey, remember, this is making you think of another work. So read that one and think about how we've defined justice there, how we've talked shit about the poets there. And I'm very interested in that piece because he calls the poets demiurges in the Republic, which is the same word that he uses for the craftsman who's the creator of the cosmogony in this man. And so there seems like this both. And again, with the criticism of the poets on its face, you can say Plato criticizes the poets and says, you know, they tell these bad stories about the gods and they make the gods look bad in this these myths. But then again, there are ways that Plato is always referring to Homer and Hesiod throughout his works. And so it's similar that at first it seems like a criticism, but there's always these subtleties to Plato.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, and then, like, I mean, and again, I haven't read this, but it seems to me that the craftsman could also, like, be connected with the poets because the poets are also, like, inventing this story.
Yes, exactly.
Like, you know, quote-unquote inventing. Yeah. But yeah, so he's almost, like, and it's interesting to use the same word then because it's like, well, are you then talking about a poet but in the framework of the craftsman, the creator, or whatever it was. Yeah.
And there are even points in the Timaeus, I think they're both in the Timaeus and not in the Critias, where the characters talk shit about Homer and Hesiod. They say, in relation to the myth of Atlantis, they say, if Solon had focused on his poetry and not been distracted when he came back to Athens, which again is like, oh, he had some work to do as the Athenian lawgiver, and he came back to Athens.
Mm-hmm.
There's all this stuff. Well, I have to look into this more, the Solon piece. And so he goes away, he's forced to go away, and then he comes back. And but they say he would have been the best. Homer and Hesiod would have been nobodies if Solon had come back and he wasn't distracted and he kept up with his poetry. And then there's another part in the Timaeus where they say, like, you know, Homer and Hesiod, not very good. So again, it's like a competition with these people who didn't ever live and also died 400 years ago.
And like, the Solon bit I remember too, because it is very specifically like, if he hadn't gotten distracted, he would have written down this story of Atlantis and he would have been the best. Like, it's so specifically about,
right.
Like, yes. It would be, we would have the full story of Atlantis because Critias is like, well, I don't totally know if I remember it right. It's too bad we don't have Solon having written it down, which is so interesting. Yeah. I mean, that Plato just really messes with your mind, doesn't he?
Like, yes, and I think so, and that again is this theme of like, it's a likely story, it's probable, we heard it somewhere, there's this hearsay. They keep calling the myth of Atlantis hearsay, which is really interesting.
Yeah.
And this kind of ties back to a theme that we find in Hesiod, because there's also an interesting kind of narratological thing that happens when the muses talk to the poet, who's called Hesiod, and they come down and they call the poet a belly, a hungry belly, and they say, we know how to tell lies that look like the truth. We know how to tell the truth when we want to, and also when we want to, lies that look like the truth, that seem like the truth. And so there's this setup really early in the Theogony where it both gives a history of how this story is coming to into existence, and it tells you why you should believe in it, because there's a link between the Muses and Zeus. And so this is, you know, coming from the gods, but also maybe you shouldn't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's always this play with like truth and what the truth is about these stories, and whether, you know, they're always thinking through what even does truth mean when we're talking about myths.
Mm-hmm. Which, God, is a good question when we're talking about Atlantis. Lord.
Right, exactly. So even in Plato, and even 400 years before that,
yeah,
when they're not talking about Atlantis, but they're even then asking, you know, what is the truth about this story? And does this story even make sense to ask whether it's true?
Mm-hmm. So what you're saying too about the hearsay thing. So I don't know more than I read a footnote recently in, I was covering the Alcestis. And like there's a moment, no, is it the Alcestis? No, or no, it was the Trichiniae that I think this one was in, where it was like, Deianira wants proof that Heracles like has been poisoned, and she like won't believe it from anyone who heard that it happened. Like she has to talk to somebody who saw it happen. And then there was the footnote that said that like in Athens, like hearsay was like just totally invalid or something like that. But it was just like a particular dig at the idea of hearsay being like recognized. So I don't know about like how widespread that was or how specific it was or what have you, but it's just interesting to then hear that Plato was talking so much about hearsay, and like if it is like accurate that in Athens that hearsay was particularly like not respected or not believed, then that kind of adds something more to his like, just, I mean, the whole, all of the Critias is hearsay, mm-hmm. let alone like, yeah, even talking about it specifically.
This is interesting. I don't know what, I'd have to look up into sources that talk about hearsay in the law court setting. That is not an area of my expertise, but I do think that this might be different, partially because of the emphasis on oral performance.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's more about that.
And learning from oral performance, and like learning a poem and memorizing it. And then that's happening. It's hard for us to even conceptualize. But, you know, if you're in an oral culture primarily, then you're not memorizing based on writing things down. Mm-hmm. You're memorizing because you're listening to them. But there is also, Plato is not, he makes it more challenging to say anything about this. Mm-hmm. Plato makes it hard to say anything about this because he's like, oh, I learned this from hearsay, and the story was learned from hearsay, but I learned it as a child, so I remember it really well, because we all know, everyone knows that the things you learn as a child are stick in your memory. But at the same time, Critias says that, and he says, I don't know that I remembered this correctly.
Yeah.
And I had to practice telling this story, and it was through telling the story that I remembered it. And so there we've got like both oral performance, memory, and forgetting all at once. Which, again, Plato's making my job really hard.
Yeah, really. God, I can't imagine. Like, I had so much trouble just with reading this one piece. Like, Yeah, because he's just, there's just so many layers. And then also, it's very like
layered.
You were saying,
it's very layered.
Yeah, and like you were saying, like, you can't say Plato said blank because Plato never says anything himself.
But you also can't say Solon said.
No, exactly. And you can't say Socrates said. Like, yeah, it just exactly. reminds me of a great joke that the Ben of the memes on Twitter, classical studies memes, shared, which is just that Socrates was invented by Plato to sell more philosophy.
Oh, yeah.
And like, it just feels very accurate because it's like, what did anyone actually say, though, Plato, like you included? Like, what is your actual opinion on something mm-hmm. versus mm-hmm. opinions that you want to play with through the voices of others? Because mm-hmm. like, if the Critias is anything, it feels like a just a thought experiment. Like, you can't actually tell what Plato thought about anything. Like, he's just, like, playing with ideas and just putting them into other people's voices so that he can play with ideas. Because if you make a mm-hmm. bunch of people say totally different things, you can have this, like, really wild back and forth of ideas and just, like, just completely mess around with everything by putting them in other people's voices and then make everyone's life a lot harder 2,500 mm-hmm. years later.
Well, it's very funny, too, because the Timaeus becomes so influential that it has this vast impact on monotheisms and creationism. Hmm. And people really want the Timaeus to be what Plato thought and what Plato said, and presenting this cosmogony and building off of that, both in the Roman world and going forward. So they want that character to be a mouthpiece for Plato, but they also and it also attracts, this dialogue attracts like the worst philosophy bros.
Plato? Because it's so terrible. Plato attracts bad philosophy bros? What are you talking about?
The worst. And, you know, some of my best friends. but part of it is people get really trapped in this web of trying to pull out the arguments, and they make these arguments in philosophical papers that I have to read then, that are like, this is what the meaning of the Timaeus is, and he's using ekos muthos here and ekos logos here, and it has this really important meaning in the elements, and these are a bunch of references to the pre-Socratics, which is all interesting. But as my classicist approach to it, like coming from a classics background, is mm-hmm. it's set at a festival. What does it mean that it's set at this festival and that we have these character choices? And then that, you know, so there's this really weird thing at the end of the Timaeus where he talks about how women come into existence. He's already gone through everything else except women and animals.
Sure.
And he even says, like, oh, I don't need a lot of time to talk about this. This is very minor, very minor points. And it's like incredibly misogynistic, the Timaeus part of the Timaeus, his speech. And there's actually parts at the beginning of the Timaeus with Socrates where it's much less misogynistic. He says women can do the same things as men. They can have their bodies tuned, or their women can be tuned in the same way, which is a big theme in the Timaeus, is this sort of celestial tuning. In any case, at the end, when he's talking about how women come to be, it's through a kind of de-evolution that the bad men become women, and then the worse ones become animals. And so that's how we get everything else. And people are like, well, what do we do with this part? I like that they want to hold up, and they're like, this is the story of how the world comes to be, but just ignore that. And the commentators on this part, it's very interesting because they're just so embarrassed We also, at this point, get the introduction of the Wandering Womb, that the story of, so, like, what's going on with reproductive organs and how sperm is this ensouled thing that's brains. It's like, okay, maybe we shouldn't get into that part.
No, but please. Okay. I'm here for it.
So the sperm part is like, it's the same stuff as the brains, and that comes through. I won't, I guess, give this link to my mom. the men have this lively desire for emission.
Their brains.
Yes.
Okay.
And the womb wanders, but both are called, so we've got this very, the womb is an animal, an indwelling animal that wanders when women haven't given birth and they want to. But the male reproductive organs are also indwelling animals. So there is a little bit less misogyny than it might first appear. But then reproduction comes about. And there's no explanation from Timaeus about this kind of chicken and egg problem about how we get the first woman. If there's no, you know, how do bad men, the next generation becomes women, but there's no logical, does not fill the logical gap of how the first generation gives birth to the second generation. But it's an impossible thing to explain.
Because it's all
so that's bizarre. The thing.
Yeah.
It's an impossible thing to explain. And they're trying in this dialogue to explain things that are impossible to explain, which is also what a cosmogony is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know? And so, like, when we get these anthropogonies and these cosmogonies, it's not possible logically to give a analytical explanation of this. Mm-hmm. And so they have to come back to a version of myth if we're describing myth as a story that's an explanation.
Yeah. Wow, there's just so much in there. Okay. Sorry, going back to another question that I think helps with all of this. So how was Plato's all of this disseminated? Like, so, oh, and how, so, okay, it's set at a festival, but we're not, it's not set like publicly at a festival, right? It's like after the festival.
It's like an evening. Yeah, they're having a banquet, and they had a banquet the previous night, and the previous night Socrates had given them the speech, and so now they have this feast of speeches, and this is the second night where they're repaying Socrates with the feast of speeches. The question of how Plato's work was disseminated is a very good one, and it's so funny with classics. I don't know. You would think this would be like a very something you would learn first.
I'm glad to know that it's not. Yeah, that's just like somehow I've missed this.
So with classics, it's so funny because, you know, we know things based on whether people refer to them offhand in a comedy, things like this. You know, are they talked about in a treatise? Does Plato himself talk about them? A lot of our sources for the performance of poetry at festivals come to us through Plato, because he has characters who are rhapsodes, or he sets things at festivals. And so it's interesting that it's not as though anything survives that's like, here is the explanation of the Panathenaia, but we cobble these things together by material remains when we can find, like, oh, we've got a list of the people who won this event written on a stone. That's also not my area of expertise, but I think that happens.
As far as I know as well. Certainly with tragedy, that's what I've gathered.
Yeah, and so with Roman things, you know, we've got more images of what scrolls look like. And how I assume that Plato's work is written on a scroll, and both most of the reading culture in both Greece and Rome, I'm going to make this statement. You can fact check me. I may be wrong. Most of the reading culture.
I make a lot of statements like that.
But I should know. Most of the reading culture is reading aloud. So there's much less reading quietly by yourself and a lot more reading aloud socially. And, you know, books are, there's not codexes. So in the same structure as we have with a book with pages, but rather scrolls where you've got a, you're rolling it open and you've got like a block of text and then one block.
Oh, is that how it went?
Block. There's no spaces in between words.
Yeah, that's fun.
Also that.
No punctuation. But,
so you do have these sort of like blocks of text and then each book is a scroll.
Right.
But I don't know, you know, how much, who has access to what scrolls or how these dialogues are disseminated. I'm very intrigued by the relationship between didactic oral poetry, like Hesiod's, where he's talking about concepts like justice. There is no he in Hesiod, but he is talking about concepts of justice. What is justice? Sort of trying to, there's these questions. How does the world come into existence? Who are the gods? Genealogies and philosophers take up similar questions and run with them once we get the development of writing. But does the philosophical dialogue relate in form to a practice of philosophizing through oral poetry is one of my main questions. And how would we even talk about that? But I think there's more of a continuity in that time period in how philosophical thought develops over time than is recognized. If that makes sense. Does that make sense?
Yeah, because you brought like how much you brought up about like the fact that he's really commenting so much on oral tradition and everything, and like this whole idea of the speeches after the festival and all that. It's just so interesting then to look at like, okay, but how is his work like shown, and like what, yeah, like how broad was like knowledge of what he's saying. And it's especially because like because he's making all of his works are these dialogues, like it is so interesting to think about then it being read aloud, even just to like convey the information. And just and I mean, because I mean that's so foreign, or not foreign, but like it's just so different when you're thinking about like certainly what I do, which is like all oral storytelling and like what has come down through the myths and everything. Because then even just generally reading Plato, I'm like, oh right, it's prose. That's weird, you know? And like, and that's so, it's so interesting that, I mean, and I guess it's just sort of like the nature of what he's doing, but that, you know, he is writing in prose and like disseminating information, but also commenting upon the ways that information is disseminated.
Yes, for sure. And the other thing about the philosophical dialogue that's really interesting and that is again a trap is that it's a genre and there's all of these conventions and it's very artificial. So it's not as though he's recording speech, right? He might make it seem like that by having people say, of course, Socrates, or, you know, there's all of these kind of interjections. But, and if you read it, it does not read like how people talk. He's not trying to make it realistic.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about that. It's about how to do philosophy. And I don't know that. I think this is like a still a question of how to do philosophy well. And personally, as someone who's very on the side of, there's a big divide in the world of philosophy, and I really am super tangential to the world of philosophy. Sitting over here being like, it's set at a festival. You haven't read Hesiod.
Like, that's why I'm talking to you. Like, I don't need to talk to philosophers. I want to hear the classic side of it, the history side of it.
But as you're talking about, like, it's, you know, so how is philosophy done now? There's people in the analytic schools of philosophy. Here I'm going to talk shit again. The way that people do philosophy is so strange and so artificial. And there's these generic conventions of how we set up a formal argument about things, and only people who are trained professionally to read these philosophical articles can make sense of them, articles and books. And you might have a question about what is gender, and that's a philosophical question. You may have a question about why are stories told in the way that they're told, how do we actually disseminate knowledge, and what does that mean? And the answers to those questions in the formal sphere of philosophy right now most popularly, at least in the academy, being told in this weird format. And so when we think about the philosophical dialogue and Plato's use of myths, this is a thing that I'm really interested in, because he's mimicking the way that Homer and Hesiod are telling these stories, sort of, to make these allegories to then get his point across. Right? And so he's got a different technique, but I honestly, I mean, we can argue that it's hard, as we've said, reading the Timaeus, not the most fun. Reading the Critias, the little that survives, also strange. It's better in the Greek.
It's something else.
But maybe not worth spending 10 years of your life for. I don't know. yeah, so there's a different way that it's being done, then these questions about this way of like delving into doing philosophy. The other thing that's really interesting, that like the answer to all of Plato's arguments is that doing philosophy is the best. Like the question is always like, what is the best life? And the answer is always philosophy, duh. Which is just, it's such a cop-out, and it's like, oh, was this constructed to, you know, sell more philosophy, to, you know, get more students to sign up for the next year of philosophy in their undergrad? It worked on me.
Was Plato just a capitalist icon? Like...
The neoliberal universities, they love him. Yeah, so, you know, I don't know. I think Plato is, I would say, read the Symposium.
I've read bits of it. I've read the Soul bit.
Yeah, the Symposium is like a much more fun dialogue to read than the Timaeus or the Critias. So unfortunately, that like Aristophanes' Soul bit did not become as famous. Another Aristophanes fact that I found really interesting that was brought up today: the first reference we get to Socrates is from The Clouds by Aristophanes. Yes. So that's the first fictionalized Socrates. At least that's what a professor said in a class today that I'm TAing for. So she could be wrong.
Yeah, fair enough.
I don't think she's wrong. So Plato's, and there are many different fictionalized Socrateses, which is another interesting thing. So the Aristophanes Socrates is just horrible, such an asshole. Not that Plato Socrates is not an asshole, clearly also an asshole. But the way that he's portrayed is very different in mm-hmm. different sources. And so this also makes me wonder about your question of how are Plato's works being read and consumed and talked about, mm-hmm. especially in this time period, which is so close to Socrates' life, you know, and he's being fictionalized in this way where the sources are all so different. How mm-hmm. are they talking about this then? Are they like, this is very strange, Plato, this way that you've gone about describing this guy we all know to be terrible?
Yeah, like how much do we actually know about Socrates beyond Plato?
I think that people, you know, gosh, you know, this isn't my area of interest to think about real people.
I respect that. Yeah.
I'm like, think about the festival context. But, you know, other people try to triangulate the sources around Xenophon, Aristophanes, and Plato and say, you know, this is what this guy was. I think in some ways it's always more interesting to look at how things are received, even like in mm-hmm. scholarship, to think through oftentimes, especially with classics, because our scholarship is so terrible. It's so old. It goes so far back that there's a lot of misogyny in there too, and racism. And so are you shocked?
The old white men that developed classics were racist and misogynist?
Yeah. And it's very funny too, like in these commentaries when they're like, they just totally exclude women from the group of people who might be reading them, you know?
Thank you so much for all of this. It's been so much fun. I'm kind of just utterly thrilled that you decided to talk about the Timaeus instead, and then I got all this background on Plato that I get to add to the whole Atlantis situation. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Yes. I'm so grateful that you invited me on the show. It was great talking with you, and I hope I can come back.
Absolutely. Especially since you said you liked Ovid, too. So I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
We can talk about a lot more. Well, great. Why don't you tell my listeners like where people can find you to learn more or follow you or whatever you want to share or don't want to share is also fine. Every time somebody gives me that face, I'm like, you don't have to.
That's great. I do not want to be found. I mean, I'm a PhD candidate at the University of Washington. And if you have questions on the Timaeus or Plato in general or myth in Plato, I do have a Twitter. I don't know what my Twitter handle is. I should know.
I mean, I'll put it in the episode's description as I always do. Don't worry about
it. Okay. my Twitter is my name, but, you know, analytical philosophers don't at me.
Yeah, they won't. They don't listen to me. Don't worry. Yeah. Not after how I handled Plato.
Analytical philosophers don't like Plato. The enemy of enemy is my friend. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm. No, they're not all about that for the most part. But yeah. Yeah, it was so great to talk with you about Plato and about myth, and I would love to come back and talk more about Ovid or other things.
I am very glad because that was very fun. And what the listeners don't know is that we also spent like a half an hour just like chatting about nothing beforehand. So we've really kept each other way too long. This has been very fun.
I have to go and, home like, to my cat. Yeah.
Oh my God. My cat's been yelling at me too. So yeah, yes. I'm with you.
Yeah. Also follow my Twitter for pictures of my cat, who is the most beautiful cat.
My cat is literally screaming at me in this
moment.
I hear
her, yeah.
Yeah, you are being incredibly loud, sir. My God. Ugh, this episode was so much fun to record. As I think you can tell throughout, but particularly at the end there, I had to cut out a bunch because honestly, we talked forever and about so many things and it was just So, so fun. I really hope to have Caitlin back on the show because I would absolutely love to talk to her about Ovid now. Whew. All a part that I had to cut out, but still exciting. I really hope you enjoyed this episode, learning more about Plato and how he did what he did, specifically about the Timaeus and how it connects with and mimics even Hesiod. Oh, it's all so fucking interesting. It's almost like the ancient world and the people who lived there were seriously fun to learn and think about, you know? Thank you all for listening because fuck, I love this so much. And huge thank you to Caitlin for joining me. What a fucking fun time we had. For you. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is written and produced by me, Liv Albert. Michaela Smith is the Hermes to my Olympians and handles so many podcast related things, from running the YouTube to creating promotional images and videos to editing and research. And it's especially wonderful when she does those things last minute because I'm really bad at editing on time sometimes. Stephanie Foley works to transcribe the podcast for YouTube captions and accessibility. The podcast is hosted and monetized by Acast. You are all the best. This is so fun. How is this my job? I am Liv and I love this shit.
Picasso knows your vacation home is your best home. It's the place that brings family and friends together. It's where you're the best version of yourself. Picasso makes it easy to co-own a luxury vacation home in amazing locations. Listings start at $200,000 for 1/8 ownership. Picasso does the hard parts for you. Luxury furnishings, maintenance, billing, scheduling, and more. With a home management team that provides support before, during, and after your stay so you can focus on the relaxing, hosting, and making memories with family and friends. And you can resell on Picasso's marketplace anytime, historically for a 10% gain. With Picasso, you can stop saying someday and start building family traditions today in a vacation home you own and revisit time after time. Visit Picasso.com today to see thousands of luxury vacation home listings. That's PACASO.com.
Snagajob is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.